Okay, so I want to tell you about some work that I've done in collaboration with Jesse Taller and Frank Tachman, both of them at LBNL, and this is sort of papers that you can read if you want to learn some more about it. Okay, so I want to tell you about event generation. So the first, there's really two questions that you have to answer or ask in event generation. The first question is, well, what is the underlying theoretical model that you're trying to distribute events according to? That's question number one. And then question number two is an algorithmic question. How do you go about writing a program that actually distributes event according to a certain distribution? So let's ask the first question first. What is the theory that we want to put into an event generation? There's really sort of two tools that people use. The first one is what I call matrix element techniques, and that is, or another word for this is Feynman diagrams. So we literally take a quantum field theory and we start to calculate cross sections using the Feynman rules, really the quantum field theory. There's many advantages of this. There's also several disadvantages, and I'll contrast this in a second to the second approach, which is the parton shower approach, which I'm sure almost everyone here has run Pythia at some point in their lives. And so what a parton shower is doing, it's not using the full underlying theoretical model or theoretical theory that we're trying to distribute to according to, but it's using some approximations of that theory. Okay, so let's try to contrast these two things. So matrix elements, let's start down here. Green is positive, red is negative. So what is positive is, of course, that you know we're really using the underlying theory. Think of E plus E minus to QQ bar or E plus E minus to jet. So we're really using QCD to describe things. So clearly we're getting you know all regions of phase space. We're just going to get the right answer because we're using the right theory. Typically the way we do calculations, we use perturbation theory. So, you know, we can do tree-level calculations, but we also know it's very easy to include quantum effects like loop corrections. Now, this is very different for parton showers, which, as I said, use an approximation to the underlying theory. And so, for example, what a parton shower is using, it's using the splitting functions, the Altobelli-Parisi splitting functions. I'll tell in a second the more what that does. But in a short way of saying this, a parton shower is only correct if particles split at sort of low PT, at low transverse momentum, right? We all know that the Altobelli-Parisi splitting functions are only right in the collinear limit of QCD. And so what that means is only in some regions of phase space are parton showers right. So if you use Pythia to try to make a prediction for E plus E minus to 5 jets, you're going to get a horribly wrong answer. Just because the parton shower is not actually designed to get the right answer for multiple high PT jets. And also, a parton shower relies on Altobelli-Parisi splitting functions, which are classical splitting probabilities. Once you have the word classical in there, you immediately lose any quantum information like loops and things like this. So this sounds pretty bad for a parton shower, but there is reasons why people spend a lot of time writing these parton showers. And the main reason is that if I look at, especially at LHC, we have like events with many, many, many particles in the final states, you know, tens or maybe even hundreds of particles in the final state, and try to calculate a matrix element, say for glue goes to 15 gluons, it's impossible to try this matrix element. I believe glue to 10 gluons is like 10 billion Feynman diagrams or something like this, so I'm not going to do that. Okay, so we're really limited by the amount of particles that we can put in the final state, mainly for technical reasons. So the number of Feynman diagrams goes roughly like n factorial, where n is the number of particles in the final state. Whereas a parton shower, remember, it uses a splitting function. So I'm starting with some final state, let's say E plus E minus to QQ bar, and then I'm going to use a splitting function to turn one of these quarks into a quark and another and a gluon. And then I take, may say, that gluon and split it into two more gluons. So sort of iteratively, I'm starting to build up many particles in the final state, and therefore I can really get an arbitrary number of final state partons. And this is why, if you want to use really an event generator, to produce exclusive events, something that really can be run through a detector simulation, this is the only way to go. There's another issue actually with matrix elements, which is really a physics issue, that typically matrix elements use fixed order perturbation theory. That's what we usually do. We calculate Feynman diagrams. And it is well known that in many kinematical regions, once I have a large ratio of scales in the problem, say I have a low transverse momentum, then there's logarithms of these ratios of scales in the problem, which are not typically captured by these matrix element calculations. I only see them if I include higher order corrections. Whereas a parton shower actually has what is known as a Surikov factor in it. So all the leading logarithmic terms are actually properly resummed in a parton shower. So there's a physics reason why we want to use a parton shower, and then there's a technical reason why you want to use a parton shower. And so really, if you compare these two, what you realize, matrix elements are much better for large PT emissions, because that's where these two things dominate, and we typically don't have 50 large PT emissions anywhere, so we can really use matrix elements. But for small PT emissions, say jet substructure, things like this, that's really where you want to use a parton shower. Okay, so, but what you also see, I've now told you we have two approaches and they're really complementary to one another. So clearly what you want to do, you want to combine the two. And again, this is not new. People are doing this, and anybody who's running MadGraph or MadEvent, and then at some point there's an option of running it through Pythia, that's exactly what you're doing. You're combining the matrix element calculation with the parton shower calculation. So the idea here that you want to accomplish is you want to calculate an n parton final states using matrix element techniques, say 2 to 4, 2 to 5, 2 to 6. This will include the full interference of QCD, or QCD for me always stands for the underlying theory. I was thinking here about E plus or minus QQ bar, but any underlying full theory, you really use the full interference. And then you can incorporate higher order correction perturbation theory and so on. But then I have this resulting final state with maybe 5, 6, 7 partons in the final state. And then I want to add a parton shower on top of this to really get the exclusive, the high multiplicity final states. This is what I said. It will generate the fully exclusive final states. And then it will also incorporate properly the Surikov factors that are really important at these low PT emissions. These logarithms are really important. Now, there's three main problems if you just sort of naively, if you start to sit down and say, well, how would I do this? You can very quickly come up with various ways of doing this, and you typically run into three problems. The first thing is, if you try to go to higher orders in perturbation theory, we all know there's infrared divergences in loop diagrams that are canceled by real emissions. However, and I'll show you this in a second, maybe I should just go through this and have three slides at the end. So there's uncancelled infrared divergences, problem number one. There's uncancelled logarithmic dependence on a matching scale, which is an unphysical scale, which is bad. And then there's an algorithmic problem, which is a double counting of phase space. So why don't I just go one slide on each. So imagine we were trying to do the following. I have some process that produces two, say, quarks in the final state. Think of E plus E minus coming in, QQ bar coming out. So I can use MatGraph to calculate, you know, this matrix element. Well, I can do this on paper, but anyways. Then I can do E plus E minus to three partons, say QQ bar glue, and think of this here as QQ bar and two gluons, for example. Okay, so I can use a matrix element calculation, just calculate these differential cross sections. But then I said I want to now add a parton shower to this. So clearly what I want to do is I want to take this, for example, this configuration here, and start adding a shower to it. So let's say I start from a two-body configuration. Now my parton shower will take one of these particles and split it into two, so I end up with a three-parton configuration. Then I can take one of these partons and split it again. I will have a four-parton contribution. So once I start a parton shower on this, I will generate a three-parton configuration, a four-parton configuration. And it's very obvious you have to be careful that you don't have double counting, that you don't populate the same regions of phase space here as you already did here, because remember, this was the correct answer. So if you now add something to it, you're going to get the wrong answer. So this is something you have to worry about. And now the way this is typically done is you say you put some matching scale. You say, well, I only populate a certain region in phase space by the matrix element. Imagine I say, I demand that my matrix element only gives me events where the invariant mass between any two particles is greater than, you know, 100 GeV or something. Okay, and then I demand that my parton shower can only give me splittings with invariant mass below 100 GeV. And then I clearly separate these two regions of phase space. But this one, the next slide, I'll show you where the problem comes when you do this. Now, another issue is this infrared divergence problem. So, you know, here's just, so this is a diagram that sort of stands for any loop corrections you could do. So it has two particles in the final state, but it has a virtual loop in it. Now, I know that this is an infrared divergent diagram. However, there's another infrared divergence coming from the phase space. Here, if two particles go collinear, one goes soft, and the sum is finite. But this is the kind of thing I want to use a matrix element calculation for because it's loop corrections. Now, this is an emission at small angles. That's where I want to use a parton shower for. So now I'm saying is I have two divergent terms, which while they are finite, they come from two different parts of my program. So you have to be very careful how you combine two infinities together numerically to make it finite. Oh, this is bad. Well done. Okay, so this is clearly difficult to implement since each term is separately divergent here. Now remember on the last slide I said that one way we can separate this double or deal with this double counting problem is that we just say matrix elements are good for invariant mass above a certain value. The Parkland showers are I start at a lower invariant mass, such that it only populates at low invariant mass. However, the problem is that the Parkland shower, remember, it has properly in it this double logarithmic sensitivity. That's a feature, that's good. Now, if I use a matrix element that's calculated fixed-order perturbation theory, it won't have this, which means the Parkland shower will depend double logarithmically on this matching scale, whereas the matrix element does not. So if I combine these two, I'll be double logarithmically sensitive to that matching scale. That's a completely arbitrary scale that I, as a theorist, chose. Okay, so that's bad, and we'll see, you know, this like a plot where you see how this comes out in a little bit. So you have to deal with this issue, clearly. Now, so what is a traditional approach that is done to this problem? So here we have fixed-order calculations up here. We have Parkland showers down here. And now the way we usually do this, so this is matrix element Parkland shower. So one way to think of this, of a fixed-order calculation, is saying, well, I'm doing a certain expansion around QCD, or about my underlying theory, and what one expansion that we all aware of is just the perturbative alpha S expansion. Okay, so that's one way to think of a fixed order calculation. And now Parkland shower, you should think of this, it's just doing a different expansion of my underlying theory. It's not doing a perturbative expansion, but it's doing a kinematical expansion. I'm expanding in the low PT limit. And so I'm sort of including all processes that happen at low PT. So there's really two different expansions of QCD. But on the same hand, there's a different phase space algorithm I'm going to use for both of these. For fixed order calculation, I'm typically using a fixed n-body phase space algorithm, like a Vega-style algorithm or whatever MAD event does, whereas this Parkland shower sort of is its own phase space algorithm, right? It just recursively generates phase space through the splitting, so there's some recursive phase space algorithm. And so the way you traditionally people think about this is put a separation between matrix elements and Parkland showers, and then they try to merge these two. Well, the problem is you're trying to merge now at the same time two different expansions in QCD and two different phase space algorithms. Now, the three problems that I told you, the infrared divergence and the logarithmic terms, sit over here. Okay, that's really sitting and merging these different expansions together, whereas the double counting issue is really sitting here in the phase space algorithm. And really the main problem that comes in that you're trying to simultaneously solve physics issues and algorithmic issues at the same time. And this is why this whole process of merging matrix elements and Parkland showers is quite difficult. So what the Geneva approach is doing is a very simple way. By the way, I should say that Geneva, I mean, there's an obvious reason for that name, but we didn't just make it up. It stands for generate events analytically. And you'll see, I have one slide where I motivate why this makes sense. Unfortunately, Geneva has at the moment only implemented E plus E minus collisions, so that's kind of unfortunate. But you can clearly see where we want to go with this. Anyways, so what the Geneva approach is saying, instead of separating it like this, we're going to separate it like this. We're trying to separate the physics issues from the algorithmic issues. So we have two different expansions, we have two different algorithms, and now when we're doing this, that this is really, that's where physics is sitting. That's where we do have to do calculations to merge, to find a way of merging two different expansions together. And then over here, we have to make sure that our algorithms are merged properly, that we don't have these double counting issues. Okay, so this is just what I just said. So why is this not working? The infrared diversion and the logs are sitting here, whereas the double counting is sitting here. And this is where the physics is sitting, and this is where the algorithms are sitting. And so the nice thing, the nice feature about Geneva is the separation of physics from algorithms. Once this is solved, and I'll show you how we solve this, then we as theorists can start to worry about this side without having to worry about this and understanding precisely how Herwig works or Pythia works. Okay, so here's a Geneva master formula. And in 30 minutes, we wrote about 80-page papers on this. I cannot give it full justice in 30 minutes, but let me try to give you a flavor of what we're trying to do. So the Geneva master formula looks like this. A differential cross-section is given by an algorithmic part, which we call dmc of mu, and a calculational part, which is m of mu squared. So this should remind you somehow of matrix element squared times phase space. I usually would say d sigma is m squared times d phase space or something. Now this is just a slight rearrangement of this, and I'll tell you what I mean by this dmc of mu here. But the important thing is this is where the algorithm said, once we solve this, then we just have to worry about the calculation of how to calculate this. And there's only one thing that connects these two, which is one matching scale. Okay, and that's the important thing. So the only thing that the theory calculations need to know about is one scale, one matching scale, not the details of what the algorithm here does. So what do I mean by DMC of mu? I'll explain it in pictures, because that's probably the best I can do. So let's just try to look at phase space. So everything here is now pictures. So imagine I have a two-body phase space. I denote by d phi 2, and you know this little circle is the volume of two-body phase space. I have d phi 3, which lives in this funny-shaped object, and this is d phi 4. You know, I don't have multiple dimensions on my slide. But this is, you know, I think you can picture this. And so, you know, really d phi 2 is what's populated by 2 to 2 events. This is 2 to 3. This is 2 to 4. But now you can ask the question, what if I take an event in my, take any configuration two-body phase space and I add a parton shower onto it? Okay, so I'm going to start from a two-body phase space and now I will, say, take one of these particles and split it into two. I will clearly populate a region in three-body phase space. This is three particles in the final state. Now, what is this region precisely? Well, this region will obviously depend on the details of my parton shower, one, and it would also depend on at what scale do I actually start my parton shower. So in other words, what is the maximal invariant mass that I allow these two particles to have? But clearly, there is some region here that is picked out in d phi 3, and of course, I can also do two splitting, so there's some region in d phi 4 that is picked out if I start a parton shower on this entire region here. So let's assume for a second I know precisely what this little region is. And now let's look at the remaining region in three-body phase space. And then add a parton shower onto this. So this will now take one of these particles, split it into two, will populate some region in four-body phase space, denoted by this. And you know, maybe I started this parton shower at a different scale than the other one, so there's a new scale mu 3, and the precise boundary again will depend on the details of the shower and on the choice of this scale mu 3. And so what DMC is just reordering my phase space in a slightly different way. So what we call DMC2 is all the little pieces of phase space that can be reached by starting a shower at starting from the full two-body configuration. Okay, so it's the full two-body phase space. It's the region of three-body phase space, this thing that was taken out from here, that can be reached by running a shower starting on a two-body phase space. It includes the part of four-body phase space that can be reached, and so on. And now you also understand what the scale mu is. Namely, that is the scale mu that I picked to start the shower from. Okay, now clearly, this also depends on the details of my shower, but the precise region here, as you'll see, depends on, in the end, it only depends on what scale mu is, whether that's an invariant mass or PT or something like this. Now, DMC3 is my three-body configuration minus this little region that could be reached here. And then the four-body part of four-body phase space that can be reached from starting from here and remove the piece that can be started from here, and so on. Okay, so DMC is nothing but d phi organized in terms of showered areas. Now, double counting is removed by construction. Okay, so clearly everything that can be reached by parton shower is now sitting in DMC2, and so on. Now, of course, you know, I'm drawing you pretty pictures. This is very simple to say and to draw, but of course, you might imagine this is not so easy to actually implement because I need to know precisely where these boundaries are sitting. Now, this is really what Geneva is doing, what the technical aspect of Geneva is doing to solve this issue is finding a solution of generating a DMC phase space rather than a d phi phase space. So let me just give you very quick... before I do this, very quickly, clearly from these pictures, should be clear that if I sum over all DMCs, I'm going to get back my full n-body phase, or my full phase space, and that once I have, since this covers all of phase space, that I can write a differential rate as picking out a point in this region and then just giving it some weight, some differential distribution. So the entire phase space can be reached, and every point is covered once and only once. So how can we possibly hope to achieve this? And this is my only slide here on this. And as I said, this is one 80-page paper that we have. So the whole idea of why do we think that we can write a phase space generator that knows precisely on where the edges of parton showers are? Well, because we are using the parton shower as a phase space generator. Okay, so the idea is that we write a very simple parton shower algorithm, let this, you know, just run, and it will populate face space, and that is our face space generator. And because, and the important thing is that that we have full analytical control over our parton shower. So we know precisely what our parton shower is doing. So it's not a great parton shower. You should not see this parton shower as a good model of QCD or something that has all the right physics in it. But it is just the phase space generator. The requirement that we need, that we have full analytical control over that shower. And for efficiency reasons, we want this shower to be sort of close to QCD, at least have the right singularity structure of QCD. And then the way we can find these boundaries that, you know, imagine this picture. I'm starting here with a seven. Imagine my parton shower, I let it run, and it gives me at some scale, I cut it off somewhere, it gives me seven particles in the final state. Now I can start asking the questions, well, if I were to increase the scale where I stop my shower, how many particles would I have had in my shower? Because we have analytical control, we can ask these questions, and that tells me precisely on where these boundaries are on this parton shower. Okay, so then we do this, we find these resolution scales, we find these areas here, and then we calculate the probability. Again, we have analytical control, so we can calculate the probability with which this particular phase space configuration was reached using our shower, using a phase space algorithm. And then we just reweight this to the answer we actually want it to be, and that's where this m of mu comes in. Okay, so we just reweigh whatever we generate here to the true matrix element expression or the true theoretical calculation that we want to do, and we use this resolution scale as this matching scale. So this is all I'm going to say about this. We could talk about it later some more if you want, but I just want to keep going a little bit and tell you a little bit about calculations that we're doing. And I'll show you some validation plots at the end that should make you believe at least that a parton shower algorithm is working. Okay, so the next question, so let's assume that we have an algorithm that does this, that gives me DMC of mu. How would I start to calculate this M of mu, and what physics should I implement in there, and do I want to implement there? So, deriving M of mu. So the idea is we've removed the entire algorithmic part of the problem now. So obtaining the best M of mu squared is entirely pencil and paper question, or maybe a computer question. But you know, it's really a theoretical question. We don't need to know details about how Geneva works internally. It's independent of the algorithm you use, and it really only depends on the physics you want to describe. And now it's a question for us as theorists, you know, what is the right calculation that I should put in there? What is the right physics I want to put in there? Clearly it should implement the best knowledge for a given process. And this is the important thing, is that because we've separated things, whatever anybody comes up with can be implemented in this approach. So let's just give you a few important examples here of what we've implemented. And I just, again, just do pictures just to make it a little bit easier. I have in backup slides, you know, some equation that we can use. So clearly, how do we think of, you know, what are the calculations that are easy to do? Well, it's very easy to do these perturbative calculations. Well, easy is the wrong word, but we know at least we have a, you know, well-defined procedure to do it. So let's think about E plus E minus coming in, going through virtual photon or Z to hadrons or partons. Okay, so at order alpha s to the 0, we just have E plus E minus to QQ bar. At order alpha s to the 1, we can either have a three-jet configuration where we have QQ bar glue, or I can have a one-loop correction to the QQ bar part. At order alpha s squared, I can either have two-loop to two-jet, one-loop to three-jet, or tree-level four-jet. Okay, so let's say we start and somebody hands us only tree-level calculations. That's what MatGraph hands you. MatGraph, you can say, I hand you four vectors. You tell me what the matrix element squared is for that process. That's what MatGraph is designed to do. So it calculates this, this, and this, and it just keeps going. Now, the problem is that what MatGraph does not have is any logarithmic information. And clearly we know that there's divergences here, right? If this gluon gets collinear to this quark, there's going to be a divergence in here. But we all know what's going to happen, of course, that, you know, at some point I have to detect the resolution. I can't distinguish a QQ bar glue event where the glue and the quark go right on top of each other from a QQ bar event experimentally. So I have to put some kind of cutoff to separate these two. So typically I put some invariant mass cut or PT cut or something in there. Now the problem is that these tree-level calculations, once I put a cut in here, imagine I'm generating this, you know, at a TeV or something, I put a cut in here at 100 GeV or something like this. What will happen is I'm going to be double logarithmically sensitive to the value of that cut. And so clearly, if I'm not careful on how I combine these things together, I will be double logarithmically sensitive to how I choose to separate these things. So that's typically not good. Okay, and this is really not done in any of these merging calculations. So what you want to do is, but what you notice here, I've not talked about merging, really. I've talked about physics. I'm saying is there is just, in other words, if I were to calculate what is the cross-section for three jets with, you know, at least 100 GeV invariant mass between any of these jets, I'm going to get an answer tree level, but if I go to one loop, I'm going to get an alpha S times a log squared of that scale that I chose. So that's a physics issue. Okay, so really, so it's not an algorithmic issue, it's a physics issue, and so we want to improve this logarithmically if you want to put these cuts in there. And so, what I mean by this, if we include the leading log resummation that you want to do, is it allows you to sort of combine these things together without being double logarithmically sensitive on precisely how you choose to separate these things. Now, another thing you might want to do, I should actually say these tree-level calculations are a completely solved problem. Nowadays, right? We have these recursion relations. So, I mean, people can just run a computer algorithm that just spits out an answer in a pretty fast way. We're actually getting to the point where one-loop calculations get to this level because we have automated tools to actually calculate one-loop calculations. And talking to Keith Ellis a while ago, he was claiming that maybe in a year or two we'll actually have a loop graph kind of thing that just does, literally calculates. You say I want E plus E minus to five partons, calculates it at the one-loop level. Let's just be not as ambitious. Let's just try to get the full alpha S correction in here, this diagram here. And the question is, how do we combine these three things together? Well, clearly, we have to cancel infrared divergence between these two things. This is infrared divergence, this is infrared divergence. We somehow have to combine this, to cancel this. And then what we probably also want to do is, let's just start with this, include all the leading logarithmic improvement, which will take this into account. You know, maybe you want to go even further and do all of this together and combine it with more tree-level information. Let's say we want to get the total cross-section right at order alpha s, but we also want to get the high PT multiple jet emissions right. Okay, so these are the kinds of things we can do, and I'm not going to show you the results. And these are actually all these things we have dealt with and shown if you just have the fixed-order calculations, how do you put them together to properly resum the logs and to properly cancel the infrared divergences. So let me spend the last few minutes of my talk to show you some results here. And first, I want to say, you know, there really is real code. I'm not going to do it. I think it's pretty user-friendly, so let me just show you. I'm going to start Geneva here. I'm going to say run this at, a center of mass energy of 1,000 GeV, make 30,000 particles, statistically significant event, never mind what that is. We're going to have five jets with minimal separation of 100 GeV in between them, and I'm going to use the leading order calculation, leading logarithmically improved. Then it runs, it gives you some citations, which mostly are to us at the moment. It gives you some progress bar, and then it just spits out at the end of the day, two jet cross sections, with cross sections, the pico bonds with statistical errors, and so on. It gives you a little bit of timing information, and so on. And if you want, you can get the full information, then make plots and root, whatever you want. I think it's reasonably user-friendly at the moment. What I told you is the first thing we should make sure that our DMC algorithm is doing the right thing. So what is the easiest way to do this? Well, let's just use our phase space algorithm, but then use mat graph matrix elements, calculate cross-section, compare to what mat event would give us, because mat event is using mat graph matrix elements in a different phase space algorithm. Okay, so here's just showing mat event versus Geneva. And I forget exactly how, when I say three, so this is leading order three jet events, and I think we used 100 GeV invariant mass separation between the particles. And you can clearly see that Madam and Geneva give me the same answer within the statistics. Every subprocess is right. Even if I go to six jets, it's actually embarrassingly good. Distributions look good. This is overlaid Geneva and Madam events. So this is just three jets, four jets, five jets, six jets, and the two programs overlaid over the top of one another. So I think that should convince you that, there's no difference between these, the blue curve and the points that's sitting in here, at least statistically. Okay, so the phase-space algorithm is just working. Let's look a little bit at the total cross-section, the mu dependence, as I told you. So let's imagine I'm just using matgraph. I'm going to use matgraph and include up to E plus E minus the six partons. But I don't logarithmically improve. Then I told you I should be And now let me use on the x-axis here, I have my scale mu, which is the separation of what I call 2-jet, 3-jet, and so on. So that's the scale, the maximal scale at which the shower can then add another splitting. So clearly what I told you is that if I just include leading order information, I should be double logarithmically sensitive to that scale. So what we've done here is we've just run a program, get the total cross-section for different points of mu, and these are these points here, the green points are underneath here, and then they start to rise like this. And then we sort of did a sanity check, taking these last points, and just did a fit to, I forget, like you have several terms, and you can find that there's a term in here with order one coefficient that goes like alpha is log squared mu. So we clearly are double logarithmically sensitive to this. Then we can say, well, let's include the leading logarithmic resummation here, so that some of the double logarithmic sensitivity should make it only single logarithmically sensitive on that scale. So that's that blue curve. Here again, you see these points. Now it goes in a different direction, but if you fit to this, you get that it indeed, the dominant coefficient is alpha s times a log mu, which is what you expect, again, an order one coefficient. Now the last thing I showed you is this best thing that we implemented, namely where we include the order alpha s, the virtual correction in there. So now we should have the true alpha s cross-section right, because we have all the alpha s information in there. So there should not be no more alpha s log mu term, because we have the full alpha s correction right. So if you work it out, what you expect that the dominant sensitivity now is actually alpha squared log squared mu. And indeed, this is the output of a program running this. And again, you can do a fit, and it, you know, is an order one coefficient here. So I think that's, again, some sort of sanity check that we're doing things right. Just one or two plots here, just that we're the program is, again, doing what it's supposed to do. So what I'm plotting here is a C parameter. C parameter is an event shape. The thing that you should know about this particular event shape is that for very small values of the C parameter, it's dominated by pencil-like two-jet events. For large values of the C parameter, it's dominated by spherical events. And actually, right at 0.75 is where planar events stop contributing. So everything above 0.75 is 4 partons or higher, and that's why there's actually some kink in here, which is actually a well-known feature. So what do we expect? So in blue here, I'm showing just leading order matrix element with leading log resummation. That is this answer here, okay, in blue. Now what do we expect? We expect this to get the C parameter large values of C pretty well, right? Because this is, it has all the right 6 jets, has the full matrix element information in there. It should get this part right. However, it does not have the leading order information in it. So if I were to plot then now include the leading order information, so the full alpha s term, but now only include up to 3 jets properly. So what do we expect here? We know that the leading order, that next to leading order cross section is higher than the tree level, than the Born cross section. But we also know that this virtual diagram is contributing for 2 jet-like events. So what we expect is that most of this increase in the cross section is actually coming out here in the 2-jet bin. Okay, so we expect this red curve to be correct over here. However, since we don't have, for example, 4 jet-like events at all, we expect this to be completely wrong over here. And so what if we merge these two things, if we put the next leading order together with the high multiplicity tree-level events, we'd expect the curve that gets the blue curve correct over here and the red curve correct over here, and that is precisely what that yellow curve is doing. Okay, the next thing I just want to show you quickly, that's what I said, where things are dominated, that this is really 2 jet-like events and what dominates. So look at this curve. So first of all, the yellow curve, it's just a slightly different plot, I believe. Oops, I'm sorry. Let's just go to this plot. So the yellow curve is the answer we just saw. This is mu equals 100 GeV. And now what you see here is just split up into contribution coming from 2 partons, 3 partons, up to 6 partons. So this is what I said. The blue thing, you can see that up here I'm completely dominated by 2 partons, whereas out here I am mostly dominated by this green curve, which is 4. That's what I was advocating. Okay, and then there's a little bit of 6, you know, some 5 underneath here, and so on. So what I'm now going to do in the next slide is I'm going to change this resolution scale to 50 GeV. Now what should you expect if I do this? Well, first of all, since we should be not very sensitive to the scale, you hope that the sum does not change very much. However, you would expect that these individual contributions change dramatically, right? Because what I call 5 jet at resolution of 100 GeV is completely different from what I call 5 jets at 50 GeV. So first look at the yellow curve. You know, it's changing a little bit, but that's exactly that single logarithmic dependence. But now look at these individual contributions. Look, for example, at the red curve, gone from here, down to here. Okay, the individual contributions are changing dramatically. And I think that is showing that really we have the scale dependence well under control. So let me give you a very quick outlook and then just go very briefly. So one thing we're working on, well, now there's two things we're working on right now, is A, have more theoretical calculations in there. That's a satisfying part for theorists. But then we're also working, obviously, on the extensions on the algorithmic side. Let me tell you very quickly what we're doing on the theoretical side. So in the Tevatron era, we've had mostly dealt with combining tree-level information together and merging them with Parton showers. Now in the LHC era, as I said, we have many tools that come available soon, like a Black Hat collaboration or QCD tools, which will fill that next row in, all the one-loop corrections to every process. So the question is, how do we combine all of this information together and merge it with a Parton shower? That is just does not exist. So experimentalists typically use this, get a full exclusive Monte Carlo, run it through the detector simulation, then use these types of calculation to get a K-factor out of it, and then adjust whatever they get from here. So that's clearly not satisfactory. You really want to use this calculation and hand it to experimentalists. So at the moment, we have done this. This can be done. Any triangle can be combined very, very easily, but what we're working on is really trying to combine all of this together and merge it with a Parton shower. So let me leave it at this and give you the conclusions of my talk. Clearly, having detailed simulation is very crucial in the LHC era. We need to, you know, compare theory predictions to experimental predictions. We really need exclusive event generators to do this properly. But, you know, it's not just, we also want to have the best theoretical calculation in there. It's not satisfactory. You just say, oh, let's just run Pythia, and we have all these calculations, we have all this understanding of quantum field theory, and we're still in the 80s technology of handing experimentalist results, right? So we want to find a way to give the best theoretical calculations, but in a way, as the results in a way to experimentalists that they can use. There's many traditional solutions that combine these things already, but they're typically tailor-made to specific calculations and algorithms. And the issue is what I told you earlier, that they're really trying to solve two problems at once. Now, Geneva is really a new framework that, in principle, at least allows any calculation to be implemented. And the reason it can do this is because it separates the calculation from the algorithmic aspects. I've shown you several results here that are implemented. Most of these things are in E plus and minus. And we're implementing, right now we're working on sort of this extension of having all these one-loop calculations together, still in the framework of E plus E minus. And then the next step that we're going to do, hopefully by sometime next year, is really do the extension to proton-proton collisions, the obviously interesting one, and then add heavy resonances, top quarks, and so on. Okay, I'll stop here. Thanks.
Allie first.
So you mentioned that, of course, to get the IR cancellations, you have to cancel virtual graphs and loop graphs.
Right.
But usually the way that happens, if you're not doing generators but just doing a straightforward calculation, is that the... you actually have to do the phase-space integration
right.
on the one hand and the loop integration on the other hand and then see the cancellation. Now here you've separated out the phase-space integration to a different part of the discussion. But it sounds like you've...
It's the same. It's a very similar issue. So what is traditionally done, so you use a subtraction type of thing like Catani, Seymour, whatever you want to do. And yes, you're right. The way it's traditionally done, you only do this on integrated things and have weighting functions that work properly. What is done in these, what is actually even shown in the Parton shower or in this framework of event generators, that what people have used traditionally, this MC and NLO type of framework, it actually uses the Parton shower itself as a subtraction. And that's what makes this difficult, because now you need to know precisely what the Parton shower is doing. So what we can do is we use sort of this MC, like a subtraction in the sense of MC at NLO, that we literally subtract something from one thing, add it back, and we have to be careful about the integration part. But the nice thing is we're now not tied to making the subtraction the Parton shower itself. So we're actually, what we're writing right now is using Catani Seymour as a subtraction. You're right. The issue is precisely how understanding what that weight function, that you know, right, that the measurement function that
you
they
do
have.
It on the matrix element side.
It's directly on.
Do it.
So you have to be careful. We do a calculation that will be correct once integrated. Okay, so that's of course, I mean, point by point, you have to smear to some degree, but.
Okay.
So any inclusive cross-sectional or differential inclusive, sufficiently inclusive will always be right.
Yeah, that's precisely my question. Namely, that the way you do it here is the it seems that doing inclusive prediction probably is okay, but if you want to do the differential distributions, then you must have made some approximation there already.
I still view a differential distribution as inclusive. So, I mean, a differential distribution is typically still integrated over many things, right? So the short answer is any inference safe distribution that we can come up with will be correct.
Well, but then again, that was subject to the way you do it. Then, namely that typically, if you really want to get into that differential distribution, you typically you will introduce some theoretical scale in there that we
right. Absolutely. The issue is, of course, in this combination is how do you. So the main issue is not the Catani-Seymour part, but is the fact that if you have the scale in there to separate,
right.
that you logarithmically improve that properly, such that you're not sensitive. That's actually where the complication theoretically comes in from.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what we're working on. You know, we're 80% done, but we're not fully. So that's
okay.
Exactly the issue. How do you write a Catani-Seymour type of subtraction that is logarithmically, double logarithmically improved? That's the issue. Yes.
Yeah. So you made quite clear that currently the challenge is combining analog calculation with Parton chars. Now there exist several solutions to that problem, like MC at NLO you mentioned,
Powhag.
By Frixione and Weber, then
yeah.
Powhag by Nasson and Oleari, then there is the Vincia framework by Walter Riehl and collaborators, and there is the Sherpa Monte Carlo by Frank Krauss. And if you go three slides back, I mean, that was touched in the first comment, you had that little green wedge you had on the next slide here, combining actually the real emission and the virtual corrections. This is where really the technological improvement is to be made in having a well-defined prescription which is also easy to implement in a given Parton-Shaw framework of combining these two. And actually Vincia and also the Sherpa framework do both provide at the moment solutions for doing this in a way that anybody can come using the Catani-Seymour dipole subtraction, delivering the calculation and plugging it into the formula. So I think this is as far as the usability and the interface to the theory community is concerned, is currently the best solution which is offered, which also
agree.
Works for proton-proton collisions, by the way.
Yes. No, I absolutely agree. I mean, that's exactly sort of the goal that what we're having with this here. So, you know, clearly what you want to do is you want to make it as easy because, you know, we could say, oh, a theorist should just implement this whole thing. But of course, the easier thing is to give a tool that just says, just take the fixed order. So that's precisely the way we're going as well here, is that the green wedge is Catani-Seymour in our approach right now, just because that's what's used.
So then I have a question. To what extent then do you plan to distinguish yourself from, say, the Sherpa framework or from what is proposed in Vincia?
Well, I think the issue here is that we do not... I think in Vincia, it's still the issue, if I remember right, how it works is that there's still, you need to know, I mean, the subtraction that is done, right, still depends on, you still need to know sort of how the shower runs at the end of the day. There's some, I'm pretty sure that that's right.
Well, Vincia is tailored, in that case, to match directly to Pythia. Whereas the Sherpa framework has an own implementation of its shower algorithm, and you just need to know the Catani-Seymour dipole subtraction.
Okay, I mean, then that's, okay, then, well, we should talk about it offline. I mean, I think there's some issues that are not, I mean, nothing is implemented, for example, at the moment, right, on these things, fully. I mean, there is no such thing as plus or minus to five jets at full one loop, anything, as far as I know, at least, unless this is, things that have happened recently, very recently. So we should talk about it offline. I mean, in the end, I think this will just be a framework that just makes it very easily. And maybe I should say this. Another way to look at this. So maybe this is a good part to address this. So one thing I'm talking about here is I'm just giving you examples of calculations that can be implemented, namely these combinations. But of course, nothing in here told us what we're supposed to implement. For example, what I have in mind in the end. Is using some sort of effective field theory type of calculation where I can resum next to leading, like not just the leading logarithmic terms, but subleading logarithmic terms. All of this can be implemented there. I'm pretty sure there's absolutely no tool available that allows you to do this. Okay, so you should just see this as sort of one thing. The first thing that you can do with this is combine things together, fixed order calculation in at least a sensible way together. But I mean, the nice thing about this is nothing is telling you that you have to combine fixed order calculation. We can try to implement things where we have, for example, we can easily put a two-loop calculation in here at the same time and implement that. But it's no harder than just putting one-loop calculations in there and so on. So it's really the framework that I want to sell, that anything can be implemented. And you should not judge, I think, the framework by the things that we have implemented at the moment. Does that make it? So I agree with you that what we have implemented right now is of no use whatsoever to the community. Okay? I mean, nobody cares about E plus E minus. Everything that we have presented exists. The issue here is that we can implement that this framework allows us to go further. Maybe that's the clearest way of saying this.
Okay, on that note, let's thank Christian again.